This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Rhode Island's governor announced just this afternoon that the Ocean State is going to lift business restrictions before Memorial Day. The first big step will come just around the corner, May 7th, the same day New Hampshire finishes lifting all of its restrictions. Now, just last Friday, New Hampshire lifted its mask mandate. Texas lifted its mask mandate in March. Florida has been mask-free since late last year. Here in Massachusetts, yes, more people are getting vaccinated, but we are not joining other states in relaxing our masking or distancing guidelines. Now, recently in one of our Ask the Doctor segments, we heard from a caller, Dave in West Roxbury, who questioned the efficacy of our state's restrictions. Here he is.
Why are we right and Texas is wrong? They've been essentially unmasked since the beginning of March. I don't see CNN in front of the hospitals in San Antonio and Houston and Dallas. I see them in other places, but not there or any other city, state that's unmasked. And at what point do we have to say the risk of COVID is far less than the collateral damage of remaining the way we are?
Now, I want to note, we are in the fourth and final phase of Governor Baker's reopening, but Dave's question is one that we hear often. And while public health experts here maintain the restrictions are important, we did want to dive into that question further. Well, we were lucky because Dr. Ashish Jha has agreed to dive in with us. He is the health policy researcher and dean of the Brown University School of Public Health. Dr. Jha, great to have you back.
Thank you for having me back.
So I want to just start, Dr. Jha, with your response to Dave's question. Are we doing better than a state like Texas, which has had much less or fewer restrictions throughout the pandemic?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And as you might imagine, it comes up a lot. And I would start by saying to Dave, there are a few things. First is here's what we know about how the virus spreads. Here's what we have learned over the last year. We know that the virus spreads most efficiently when people gather indoors and are not wearing masks. That's what we know. That's where almost all of the spread tends to happen. So outdoor mask mandates probably matter far less than indoor mask mandates. Second, so much of this is also about behavior. And third is, and then I'll get specifically to Texas, but and third is, of course, the fact that there are different different temperatures and different weather patterns in different parts of the country. So right now, when I look across the U.S., I see the highest number of cases in basically the northern half of the country. And the southern half of the country is largely doing pretty well. And I think part of that explanation, a large part of that explanation, is the weather is very different in Texas right now than it is in Michigan. It's relatively warm. People are spending a lot of time outdoors. Restaurants can be open with windows open. That's pretty tough in northern Michigan in March and April. So restrictions are one layer of public health, but there's a lot of other factors that go in. And maybe I'll just finish by saying, you know, this is what we saw last spring. And then, of course, once we got into late May, June, we saw things flip where Arizona, Texas, and much of the South really lit up with infections because the weather got pretty hot and people started spending time indoors. So you can't look at any single moment and figure out what the public health policies should be. You've got to look at the whole picture. And Dave's absolutely right. Texas is doing better than Massachusetts right now.
So as we look at that whole picture, one of the things that we looked at was death rates. Massachusetts has a much higher death rate than Texas. And in fact, we rank third overall in deaths per 100,000 people, according to the New York Times. We have been more restrictive than many states. That is another way that people measure whether our restrictions have worked. How do you address that piece of the puzzle for us?
Yeah. So a lot of the deaths that happened in New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Michigan were really part of that initial wave. And there's no doubt about it that we've done, we did much worse. And we just got slammed. And much of the East Coast did, Michigan did as well. And other parts of the country were slower in terms of getting hit by the infection. So There's a different, in my mind, from a policy point of view, there's what happened last March, April, May, when none of us really understood what was happening with this virus and how widespread it was. We really do, in my mind, have to take that apart, take that out from the rest. Since then, Massachusetts has actually not done that badly. and the restrictions have clearly worked in keeping infections and deaths down. Though, let's be honest, there have been times when Massachusetts has lifted restrictions early, and we've seen surges of cases. And, you know, at the end of the day, the any single one of these things has to be understood in the context of the population we have. So obviously, different states have different populations in terms of how many vulnerable older people, how many at-risk minority populations, and other types of populations. That also drives death rates. My overall view on this has been, we can't look at a snapshot at any given moment. We have to look at the trajectory of the disease and how these restrictions or public policy efforts are shaping the trajectory of the pandemic.
You know, I know you know we've been doing Ask the Doctors for more than a year now, and we've been lucky here on Radio Boston that there are so many fantastic physicians, world-renowned physicians, who appear on our show. And as these questions have come in, this awareness of seasonality seems more acute, more sharp now than I would say even, let's say, last June or July. So are you telling us, I'm going back to the first part of your answers, are you telling us that we're learning something now that might suggest that you don't compare in a given moment what a northern state and a southern state does, but you compare their restriction decisions against their own seasonality? I feel like maybe I'm asking that question in too complicated a way, but do you understand what I'm saying?
I do. No, first of all, I think we have learned that there is clearly a large seasonal component to this virus. And I suppose that's not totally shocking, because that is true for every coronavirus. You know, as you know, there are a lot of human coronaviruses that circulate during winter months. And they circulate in a different pattern in the northern parts of the United States than they do in the southern parts of the United States. This coronavirus also seems to follow some of that same pattern. And it's very tempting, and I think we fell prey to that here in Massachusetts, to look at where we were in July and say, look at how much better we are than Arizona in July last year, where Arizona was in really bad shape and Massachusetts was doing really well. And I don't think that was a totally fair comparison. And it's tempting in March to flip that and say Texas is doing better than Massachusetts. Well, it's Texas's policy. Seasonality is a huge part of this. If people can spend time outdoors, it makes an enormous difference in terms of the spread of this virus. When people can't, as we really can't spend that much time outdoors during our winter months, it really does set up the northern part of the country to be far more vulnerable during those months.
As I'm listening, I'm thinking, okay, so I'm a listener in my kitchen right now, or I've got my headphones on later, and I'm listening to this on my phone, and I'm thinking, but it seems like the guidance changes, right? You said at the beginning of this conversation, you called, well, you might push back on this, but it sounded like you called into question the necessity of an outdoor mask mandate, for example. And yet, you know, a few months ago, we had to have a mask mandate. Everybody had to be masked even outdoors to be safe. How do you think about, and listen, I get it. We're on a learning curve. I do get that. But we also know that when we say things definitively while we're still on a learning curve, then the next thing we say definitively feels a little less definitive to folks. So how do you balance that messaging and that frustration?
Yeah, no, I totally understand that. So let's actually talk about outdoor mask mandates and what we've done. So I would say that we have known probably since last April or May that the virus spreads largely indoors. That it's not that you can't spread it outdoors, but it's really infrequent and it requires very specific circumstances. It spreads outdoors during the times that large numbers of people pack together stationary for long periods of time. Political rallies, maybe sporting events. Those are the kinds of places where it spreads outdoors. Otherwise, outdoors is really safe. So when Governor Baker in the fall said we need to have, you know, outdoor mask mandate all the time, I think there were many of us who said, this feels really not necessary and it's going to help on the margin if it helps at all. And if Governor Baker tomorrow decided to drop a mask mandate in Massachusetts, I would be very supportive of that. I don't think outdoor mask mandates do very much. And again, except for those very specific circumstances. I think we've known that for a little while. And it's true that we probably have not done as effective of a job communicating that. Whereas indoor mask mandates or getting people to wear masks indoors is incredibly important and makes a really big difference in terms of controlling the virus.
So let's wade in then to the next tricky piece of this, which is the impact on the economy. You heard as I introduced the segment at the top, we talked about the way Rhode Island is planning to lift restrictions, New Hampshire, so these are our neighbors. We are in phase four, but we still have restrictions in place. Unemployment has been tough in Massachusetts. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has us ranked towards the bottom in terms of our ability to maintain employment, third from the bottom, including the District of Columbia. Texas ranks 34. Florida had almost complete employment retention. How does a public health leader balance those economic concerns with the spread concerns in the messaging to the public and in making these decisions? I get it. These are really hard trade-offs, and they also appear to be proving to be trade-offs.
They are trade-offs at times. And I think the key in my mind is, as a public health person, is to lay out what I think are the key public health measures as we best understand it at any given moment, about how to save lives. What we've learned, and again, you know, state economies are difficult to sort of compare on a state by state basis. Yeah. What we know when we look globally is that countries that have done a good job controlling the virus have done the best economically, and the countries that have done a bad job controlling the virus have done poorly economically. And most economists I speak with say, you know, the best economic policy is control the virus, and you can get your economy back. I understand that from a state by state basis, that can be difficult to sometimes see that information. But I think one of the reasons, for instance, that I have been saying, you know, we really do need to start thinking about lifting certain restrictions is if they're not doing much for public health, then we probably should not be doing them at this point. And we may have thought 6 months ago they were doing a lot, but once we learn that they're not, we should begin lifting restrictions that do very little. Outdoor mask mandates, maybe that doesn't have a big economic effect, but it probably isn't that useful at this point. And mm-hmm. Therefore, my take is, let's come up with a policy to get rid of that. I think there's a safe way to do that and not spread the infection further and not hurt the economy further.
Someday we're going to look back on the pandemic in the rearview mirror. We're going to have all kinds of metrics about what worked and didn't work. And we're going to look at state data, national data, global data. Looking back, what will be the right metric for did we get it right? And will we decide that New England got it right?
Yeah, it's a really good question. My take is that you have to hold people accountable based on the information they have at the moment that they have it. And so when I look at what happened to Massachusetts in March and April of last year, it's really hard to hold Governor Baker. And I have said this publicly, I think Governor Baker did a really good job, even though we had horrible death numbers in March, April, May of last year, because none of us expected the level of infection in Massachusetts and elsewhere to be as high as it was. And so when we think about which policies worked, which ones didn't, we have to put that first start in the context of what did we know and when did we know it and when could we have acted. But of course, at the end of the day, the things that matter are how many people were infected, how many people died, how many lives were we able to save. And in that context, as a nation, I would say we certainly have not done very well. Some states have done better than others. And it's, you know, it's a complicated mix of metrics. I think simple measures like the sheer number of deaths overall in the pandemic is probably not fair because states were hit very differently at different times, and holding political leaders accountable for actions that they could not have anticipated or information we didn't have at the time doesn't seem quite right to me.
All right, that is Dr. Ashish Jha, health policy researcher and dean of the Brown University School of Public Health. Dr. Jha, thank you for engaging with us in this conversation. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me back.
Many of you know former Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson, who is also the CEO of Verdant Medical Incorporated, a medical marijuana company, as a regular on this show. He also ran for mayor of the city of Boston in 2017, and during that campaign, he talked a lot about being adopted, and he had already done a bit of research into his birth family. What he found out was troubling. His mother had been sexually assaulted as a young girl and was forced to give up the baby that was Tito. After the election, Tito decided to take that step, search a step further. In 2018, he and his mother, Rachel, finally reunited. Earlier this week, the three of us, Rachel Twyman, Tito Jackson, and I, talked about that reunion, each of us in a different remote location because of the pandemic. And Tito began by telling us how his quest first began. And I do want to give a quick warning. Parts of this conversation may be difficult for survivors of sexual assault or for those who have had painful adoption experiences.
In college, I had a physician who was a pain in my butt at the University of New Hampshire. And he asked me about pre-existing conditions and my family. And I said, listen, man, I'm adopted. So I'm just going to assume that all that stuff in there is stuff that I might have a previous family history. And he said, you know, even though it's a closed adoption state in Massachusetts, you can call the adoption agency and find out what happened or kind of a narrative. And at that time, there was an organization called, well, it's been taken over by the Home for Little Wanderers now, but I think it was called Boston Children's Services. And I called them up and they sent me a narrative that was pretty disturbing. And in fact, it came at an intersection in my life where I was part of a program at the University of New Hampshire called the Sexual Harassment and Rape Prevention Program, where I was learning how to be a first responder to people who had been assaulted. And I was going to be speaking at Take Back the Night. And so the letter came to me right the day before I spoke at Take Back the Night. And it said that my mom had been assaulted by two men. And so that was really hard. And so the years pass, and then I finally reach out to the Home for Little Wanderers. You send in a little fee, and then within 2 or 3 months, I got a call from a social worker there that said, we found your mom. We just spoke to her 5 minutes ago, and her name is Rachel. I'm not gonna give your phone number out, but they gave me her phone number. and that began the connection, because I called her 5 minutes later.
Well, I can't imagine, Rachel, that phone call. Tell us about that moment.
Well, I told the lady it can't be my son because he's dead, because my family told me that he was dead. So I went back in my house and I woke up my other son. I was crying and I was probably the most anxious person in the world. And this was before Tito called me, and I woke up my other son, my oldest son, and I'm like, your brother's alive. There's a guy that says he's your brother. And it was just crazy. And then he called me and he explained to me what he had done in his life and how he had got adopted and how he's been searching for me. And I just told him that, well, we need to meet so I can tell him the truth of how he was conceived and brought into this world and what a horrible time and what a horrible life I've had just dealing with that particular part of my life.
Tito, I want to go back to Rachel and talk a little more in a minute, but hearing your birth mother tell this story now in such a brave and straightforward way, what do you find yourself thinking when you hear that out loud?
I just, you know, I think about, you know, when I went in to meet Rachel, I was really selfish. And I was very much thinking about myself, about this piece that was missing in my life and that I wanted to complete myself and kind of square off all of these things. And I was very self-absorbed at that time. And then when I met Rachel, basically instantly my self-absorption went to think about what it would mean for a 12-year-old girl to be raped, and also, you know, most of the interest in Rachel's life was in the book The Common Ground. Everyone wants to talk about desegregation. Some people call it forced busing. But she was a 12-year-old girl with a baby in her belly who was on a bus that people on the bus were essentially assaulting her, and also people outside of the bus. That's surreal to think about what that must have been like. And so essentially, I was thinking about myself, and when it comes down to it, you know, Rachel had to live that life and deal with all of those things well before I was even brought into this world. So it makes me think about the systems that I worked in as a city councilor and working in the state government. All of those systems, including the Boston Public Schools, where I was chair of the Committee on Education on the Boston City Council, they failed my mom.
Rachel, a version of your story is told in J. Anthony Lucas's Common Ground, A Turbulent Decade in the Lives of Three American Families. As Tito just talked about, the book talks about how you were bused to Charlestown from the South End as part of the desegregation efforts in the 1970s. You've also told us just a horrific part of your story. You said that Tito's conception and birth obviously were traumatic, and that for a while after, you didn't think about the baby you had given birth to because it was too painful. What made you start thinking of that baby again?
In 2010, my middle son got murdered in New Bedford. And it another devastating blow.
Yeah,
unexpected.
So
unexpected. So now I have two sons that have been taken from me. And I have a very, very good friend, Zelta Brooks, who stands by my side and who has always tried to help me get through this. And she said, you know, Rach, maybe it's time to start looking for that baby. And that's when I really consciously started looking for him. Because for a long time, I could not deal with the situation that I was raped.
Rachel, after your middle son was murdered and you decided at a friend's encouragement to go looking for that baby that is Tito, at that point, had you been told that he was dead?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I was told that he lived in a different state. He was in Ohio or Detroit. He was a gangster, drug dealer. He's running the streets. He got shot up. I was told all of that. This is by my mother's sister and brother. But the bigger problem is I had no access or way to find Tito. All the avenues that I thought I could possibly go through to find this child were closed doors. So everything was in Tito's hands. So if he didn't find me, I'd still be in the wilderness about this.
So then he finds you. You get the phone call, you wake up your other son, you tell him, you talk with Tito, and you discover that he is a person who has dedicated a chunk of his career to disparities, to righting inequalities, to taking on some of the systemic racism in the community that you experienced. How did it feel to know that that boy who you thought was gone had been out doing that work?
I was so happy. I was so happy. I'm proud of all my children. He just happens to be the one that was in the political limelight, which I had nothing to do with. All I did was bring this young man into the world. So he chose a path, maybe possibly because of how he saw his life. But I'm just glad that he wanted to give back. And it's a blessing that he's in that limelight, and it helps me get to where I need to be at.
I want to acknowledge Rachel for attempting to find me. And I think it's important that, Rachel, you talk about what happened when you made that attempt at Boston City Hall.
The death of my son really had me distraught. Through those tears, my youngest son told me, he says, Ma, we're going to go to City Hall, see if we can get the birth certificate. So we drive from New Bedford to City Hall. I went down to the birth certificate window, and I finally put 1975, and I put April. And I wrote baby boy Twyman. And I gave the paper to the lady. Me and my son stood there for a long time. And the lady came back to the window and she said, I can't help you. I can't help you because you need a lawyer. I said, what are you talking about? That's my baby. So my youngest son, he just picked me up and took me outside. It was so devastating because why doesn't nobody want to help me find this child? Oh my God. That was just a ball of tears.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry.
One also just surreal piece about that is that while Rachel was on the second floor at City Hall, I was on the fifth floor because I was a city councilor.
How does that feel, Tito?
Ships passing in the night. We have figured out that I went to Sunday school with my brother, that Rachel babysat my chief of staff, Michelle, when she was a kid, because they lived in the same building, and that I was effectively campaigning Tiziana, because I, when I was running for mayor, I gave my mom and my brother's campaign literature and asked them for their vote for the city, for the mayor of the city of Boston. So that means my campaign manager and campaign staff will be very happy to know that I distributed literature to them. And, you know, we have walked, we've literally been in the same place multiple times in our life. And this has been a long journey, had it been circuitous, but when it comes down to it, it has been so worth the journey, because I now have two amazing moms who are both 5'1", and they are giants, and I am literally the luckiest human being on earth to be able to have two moms, and Rachel and my mom Rosa. That might mean I might have been a bad kid. I had to have two, you know, it is so satisfying to be able to connect with my mom and then also my brothers, because they were that missing piece and part of me.
So you have these two now. Your birth mother is a petite powerhouse. Your adoptive mother is a petite powerhouse. I want to ask you about your adoptive parents, where they are in all of this. And if you can tell me how they're feeling about all of this. Did you talk to them? Did you tell them what you were trying to do? Did they support you?
So my dad, Herb Jackson, was a organizer. He fought literally to his death in 2002 to make sure that women.
Sorry. That's right.
Yeah. No, but he was, you know, he's a fighter. Women, people of color, and Boston residents got on construction sites. And, you know, to this day, and it's funny because my dad rarely called me my name. He rarely called me Tito. He always called me my son. When I was a younger man, I wanted to go and not be like my dad and do all this. And I'm literally doing everything that my dad was doing. So I'm grateful. And then my mom, Rosa Jackson, lives in Jacksonville. That's actually, I actually hadn't thought about that, but my mom lives in Jacksonville. And so she has been uber supportive to all of her children who were adopted. So that my parents had four kids biologically, and three of us are adopted. And I remind my older siblings that I was chosen, unlike them. They just had them. I mess with them all the time. But when it comes to my mom, she has been like so supportive. And in fact, she encouraged me many years ago to go find my mom. She thought it was really important. And she has been with me through every step of this. And just looking forward to having both of my moms in the same place at one time, because that has not happened yet. So I'm really excited for the day that comes.
Rachel, you've told us a story of a lot of pain and a lot of suffering and a lot of people who should have cared for you who let you down. And now this son comes back into your life, is ready for a relationship. What does this mean for you now, and what does it mean for your life going forward?
I welcome Tito into my life. I've had a tough life, but it's okay, because these are the benefits of me just plugging away. You know what I'm saying? I have a lot of faith, and I believe in my God, and I just knew that one day this was going to happen. I didn't know it was going to happen like this, and I didn't know he was going to be this big old guy and this public figure. And, you know, I just always wanted him to be healthy and okay. So with that being said, I live my life trying to be an overachiever and do good and be nice to people and try to raise my son so they could grow up and be productive citizens of this world. So if they ever meet this big brother, we all be proud of each other.
I'm proud of you, Madre.
Yeah.
I'm very proud of you. And I'm proud of your, like, there's so many people who would have given up. And by the way, rightfully so. Like, I'm not even, you know, there's so many folks who along the way, but your strength and your courage and your persistence and your unwillingness to give up is.
I just always wanted to be, I didn't care what else happened in my life. I just wanted to be the best mother I could be. And I wanted my children to love me. That's all I wanted. And they love me. And I just want Tito to love me.
Tito, can I ask you a couple of fun questions?
Yep.
And Rachel, hopefully you'll enjoy these too. Tito, first, why Madre?
You know, that's what she told me to call her. So she's my mama, and she told me to call her Madre. So that's what I.
Well, I'll have to answer that question. Answer that question for you. So, I live in New Bedford. I'm the neighborhood mom. I only have sons. So most of the people that are around me are male. I adopted this young man named Angel. He's Spanish, and he started calling me Madre. Because I take care of everybody's children. When they don't want to take care of them, that's me. That's what I do.
All right, Tito, last question. Do you have her eyes or her nose or her smile? Or?
I have her eyes. I have her nose. I'm a little bit taller than her. just a you know, give or take a foot and some change. But no, definitely, I definitely favor my mom. I look like my brothers. I'm a little bit taller than them too, which is it's helpful because I get to change the light bulbs in her house. My brother Steven and Michael a little bit smaller than me, but yeah, this is all nature nurture stuff. My adoptive mom Rosa is essentially the same type of person that Madre is in terms of the community. She had a daycare for 25 years. She had her 7 kids. And so I just am really, really lucky. And I thank God every day for this miracle that has been brought into my life with being able to meet my birth mom and to build a relationship with her. And it means a lot to me that she's proud of me. And it has been a very positive experience between us, but I definitely have to acknowledge the folks who this may be too much for them. And we need to honor and hold space for people who are in that spot.
This hard. I've been through so much all by myself. I thank God for just keeping me together and holding me so I can be this woman that I am.
And Madre, I love you.
I love you too.
I do.
That was former Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson, CEO of Verdant Medical, and his birth mother, Rachel Twyman, telling us the story of their reunion. For anyone listening who may need help, you can reach the Boston Area Rape Crisis Center at 1-800-841-8371 and the National Sexual Assault Hotline at 1-800-656-4673. You can also reach the Home for Little Wanderers at 617-288-7450. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I am Tiziana Deering, and it is Oscar Sunday this weekend. And in addition to the movies themselves, red carpets, glamorous stars, and acceptance speeches, it also means...
Get your popcorn ready.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
No, it cannot. That's right. If we are talking movies, you know we're talking popcorn. And I have to confess, I love popcorn. And who better to talk about popcorn than Joe Gatto, a private chef and culinary instructor based in Stoneham, the host of From Scratch on Pluto TV. Joe, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Always buttering me up. I love it.
The popcorn puns will be prolific. Listeners, back me up on this. Listeners, if you are a popcorn person, call in now. What do you love? How do you serve it? How do you eat it? How do you prep it? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Joe, popcorn was huge in my house as a kid. I have strong associations with it. We were a big, hungry family, lots of kids. It was a cheap snack. The sisters made it. They taught me how to, so it's sort of intergenerational. Why do you love popcorn?
I mean, you know, it's a lot of the similar things. You know, for me and my fam, we're always making popcorn because we're big, you know, movie fans. But when I was growing up, it was always, you know, my mom's old big orange pot going on the stove and that smell that just starts wafting through the house. You know, it just is infatuating. Mm-hmm. And it became infatuated with it. And then as I got older, I really started loving making all different kinds of popcorn from, you know, when we were making it for parties, instead of just having a plain cheese board, we'd make, you know, rosemary butter popcorn, all these different types of popcorn. Ooh. And then it just became like, you know, an obsession to the point where I felt like popcorn was going to move out of the neighborhood because they were just scared of me because I was just so obsessed with it.
All right. So I am sitting here with some popcorn in hand. I baked it. I cooked it on the cooktop, the stove earlier today. It's one of my favorite classics. White kernels cooked in oil with real butter and a little seasoned salt. This is one way to make popcorn. I have many other much naughtier ways to make it. Is there how many ways can you make popcorn?
I mean, there's a tons of ways to make popcorn, just like any dish, right? And when we're making popcorn, I mean, it's all gonna follow the same principle rules, right? We wanna cook it in an oil, and we wanna get the internal, what happens is we get the internal temperature of the kernel up to just over 347 degrees, which creates steam. And what does that do? It bursts the kernel. And that's how we get popcorn. So we're looking for, you know, our popcorn has about 14% moisture in it. So you can cook it any way, right? You just need to get the internal temperature up to 347. So over open fire, you could do, you know, on the stovetop, which is my favorite method. Or,
mine
you
too.
Know, you could do it in the microwave, but, you know.
You're not. I am not a microwave popcorn person.
Yeah,
there are Philistines in my house who will eat microwave popcorn, but I am not one of them.
Yeah, I wouldn't. Yeah, I'm just gonna ignore the microwave popcorn scene.
Okay, so listen, I want to go. The phones are popping, as they're saying in the studio. We have so many popcorn puns. Let's go to the first call, 800-423-8255. Jessica's on the line in Worcester. Jessica, you're up.
Hey, this is seriously the best topic in the Hoid world, besides, well, other things. But popcorn is my favorite snack in the Hoid world. Stovetop, you have to do it on the stove with oil, a teeny little bit of salt. But my husband always laughs at me because he says I eat popcorn so aggressively. He goes, have you ever watched yourself eat popcorn? He goes, you shovel it into your mouth. And then I
absolutely
drop popcorn all around me, but you don't pick it up at the beginning because that would just waste time. So at the end of the bowl, then you pick it all up.
Right. But is there any other way to eat popcorn?
No, absolutely not.
That's
you
why
are
we
a
have
popcorn
a dog.
Sister.
Oh,
that's
you know?
Right.
I love it. This makes my heart so happy. Thank you.
Thanks, Kelsey.
All right, so Joe, I need an excuse to eat a bite of this popcorn because it's been sitting here with this fantastic smell. So,
absolutely.
Chef's choice here. You can either tell us a little more about the history of popcorn, or you can tell us your favorite seasonings.
All right, well, I've got a couple facts why, you know, and I got to say, I'm a little jelly that you get to eat that as I'm talking, but that's fine.
Just one bite.
One of the fun things that I did in doing some research was from the Popcorn Board of America that over 13 billion quarts of popcorn are consumed every year, 42 quarts per person, which I thought was a little under in my family, but still absolutely fascinating. And some of the toppings that we love to use, well, when we do a movie at my house, and you know, I have my wife and three kids, age ranging from, you know, 3 to 11, so everyone has their different flavors. So we make a big, huge batch. Everyone gets their bowl. And for me, I mean, I love just the salt and butter, but throw a little Parmesan and fresh rosemary on there. And yeah, I'm going to need a second bowl of that. There's no two ways about it. I'm a huge fan of that. And just a little tip to the audience. If you take your salt and take a coffee grinder or a spice grinder and you grind your salt until it's fine, it's going to work much better on your popcorn because it's going to stick instead of making that little pool at the bottom that's filled with the kernels, which are actually called old maids, believe it or not. That's the terminology for the kernels left on the bottom. So, you know, that's always filled at the bottom of the bowl, right? You got the old maids and all the salt. So if you grind it really fine, it sticks right to your popcorn. So you get a nice salty, crunchy bite every time.
I did not know that. All right, more calls. We've got Linda on the line from Newton. Linda, you're up.
Hi there. How are you?
Hi, Linda.
Great.
Never called before, but popcorn is worthy of a phone call. So I love two popcorns. One is by Lesser Evil, and it's a Himalayan pink sea salt popcorn. It's so light. It's not even that fattening, but it is absolutely delicious. And the other one that I love is made by Poppy's Handcrafted Popcorn. It's salted caramel.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it's made in North Carolina. So good.
Let's talk about the sweet popcorns, Joe.
Yeah, I mean, we're big fans of, you know, kettle corn. And that's simple to make it at home as well. Kettle corn's not, it takes a little bit of practice because of the sugar and that caramelizes so fast it can burn. But kettle corn is definitely something that I love kettle corn, and it's just such a fun snack. And, you know, not great for the waistline, but definitely addictive. And I mean, you know, but and a lot of times, you know, back in the day, people used popcorn and they'd pour milk over it and use it as a breakfast cereal and put a little sugar on it. I mean, that's still common from my understanding these days. I don't do it, but I'm going to try it. That's for sure. Now that I've read about it, my son was like, "Isn't it going to get soggy?" And I was like, "Well, until we try it, you know, I'm not going to knock it, but it sounds awesome." But yeah, huge fan of kettle corn, and we actually do brown sugar and a little chipotle for our kettle corn, so it's sweet and heat.
Sounds great. One of our producers is pointing out cornflakes get soggy and we still eat them as cereal. So there you go. We have so many calls. I want to grab at least one more. Let's go to Georgette in Quincy. Hi, Georgette.
Hi. I love popcorn. I worked at a movie theater for a summer and I would stash the bags of the chips or anything else that we used at the candy station so that I could stuff them with popcorn at the end of the shift instead of throwing it away, and I would take it home and eat it with my best friend until it was gone at whatever hour of the morning it was, because I would get out of work at 11 p.m.
What a fantastic memory. Awesome. And Joe, you know a little bit about the difference between popcorn in a movie theater and what we usually make at home.
Yeah, the popcorn in a movie theater, it's interesting. They actually, you know, at home we're usually using canola oil, which you want to use because it has a high smoke temp. You know, but they actually are using coconut oil at the movie theater. And they also have a flavoring called Flavor Call, which is a fine sea salt that's actually dyed with yellow number 5 and 6. That's what gives it that bright yellow color. So, you know, it's popped in a very similar way. But with that coconut oil, it does make a difference in the flavor. And they have, you know, they also have proprietary corn that they're using. But yeah, it is a little different than we make at home, but we're going to try it with coconut oil to see if we can totally duplicate that flavor, because I mean, I know I'm down.
Yeah, no, that does sound good. We're not going to have time for more calls, but I do want to note one caller, Nancy, said she likes almonds in hers. I used to also, when I was being really naughty, like peanut M&Ms in mine. She also says, hey, let's find a different phrase than Old Maids for those uncooked popcorn kernels. I think of them as wasted potential, Joe. Maybe that's a way we can think of them in the future. It's more popcorn I could have been eating. All right, so Joe, lightning round, most unusual. This is another question a caller had. Lightning round, most unusual seasoning you've ever come across for popcorn.
Habanero.
Ooh.
Habanero popcorn. It sounded like a really, it was like habanero and sugar, and it sounded like a really good idea. It wasn't.
Okay. Well, Chef Joe Gatto, private chef, culinary instructor based in Stoneham, host of From Scratch on Pluto TV. Thanks for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's always a blast coming on, you guys. And, you know, I can't wait to watch the Oscars and eat some popcorn. Thank you so much.
Oh, me too. That's right. Get ready for Sunday, everyone. All right, that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.